the digital locks, which are intended to keep all of our machines safe. When they find a key for a lock like that, they can sell it.
If they were to sell that to another government or that type of thing, they, you know, could potentially sell that for, you know, hundreds or tens of thousands of dollars.
But Child says most researchers and hackers don't sell directly to government agencies. Instead, people like this usually sell their attacks to a small global network of brokers. In a sense, these brokers are the arms dealers of the digital age. They act as go-betweens, connecting researchers or hackers with buyers like governments and organizations who are searching for backdoors into computer networks.
You can take an exploit to one of these people and they will go forth on your behalf.
An exploit is like a key to a digital lock, and selling these things can be a lucrative business. But Schultz says it's also ethically dicey.
The other thing I have to wonder, too, with some of these brokers and vulnerability markets is, are they double selling?
Researchers like Schultz say after you sell a computer vulnerability on this gray market, you can never be sure exactly how it will be used or where it will end up. Steve Henn, NPR News.
In 2014, Uber became so much more than a car service. The startup became a symbol for capitalism itself. The company's value soared from under $1 billion to about $40 billion. It's now one of the most valuable private companies on the planet. And it's also mired in turf wars, legal battles, and scandal. NPR's Aarti Shahani looks back on Uber's extraordinary year.
From San Francisco to Beijing, Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh City, Uber is in hypergrowth. It's expanded to more than 50 countries. And while it's hard to quantify, the backlash against the company has grown too.
Stand your ground, lads!
Nevada became the first state in the U.S. to shut down Uber. In Europe, protests by cab drivers. India's parliament outraged after a woman was allegedly raped by her Uber driver. In Sydney, Australia, Uber jacked up prices during the recent hostage crisis. And in South Korea, there's a criminal indictment against Uber's CEO.
They have a window when they can try and make their money really, really quickly without all these regulatory, I would argue in many cases, necessary sleeping policemen.
Nancy Cohn is a professor at Harvard Business School.
And because it's a window that's short-term in nature, they're moving very, very fast.
You could sum up Uber's strategy with that well-known saying, it is better to ask forgiveness than permission. And it's nothing new in the history of capitalism. To become a giant, Standard Oil had to break laws on competition.
Uber is trying to very, very quickly break through medallions, state regulations about consumer and passenger safety.
If history is any guide, Cohen says, Uber can't flout the law forever. Laws help companies be accountable. Another business professor agrees that, yes, Uber's entire business depends on ignoring the law. But Aswath Damodaran at New York University says the laws are unjust.
The Taxi and Limousine Commission might tell you about their background checks and how much. I don't believe them. I don't believe them because when I get into a cab, I know my life is at risk.
He says regulators are gatekeepers. They're to protect the taxi cab monopoly. And Uber is taking a stand, one that'll pay off with customers who are also voters. And by the way, all the bad press Uber's been getting, Damodaran says it's no coincidence. And it's not because Uber drivers are bad. It's because Uber has made enemies.
Trust me, there's going to be a crisis every month, pretty much, for Uber. And Uber has to react in a mature way.
It felt like a little bit immaturity and...
Senator Al Franken of Minnesota is searching for the right word to describe Uber's reaction to a crisis.
It may have been arrogant, but I think it was more clueless.
This fall, a top Uber executive allegedly said he wanted to use Uber data to dig dirt on reporters who criticized the company. In response, Franken sent a congressional inquiry asking Uber to spell out its privacy practices. And to be crystal clear, Franken is not an Uber hater. He's a user because of his wife.
My wife sort of runs our, you know, how can I put it, our lives.
Franken visits his daughter. Other people visit their mistresses. The senator asked if Uber stores the date and time of every user's trip. for what purpose, and which employees have access. And he says Uber's letter back was disappointing.
I usually expect direct answers to those questions and detailed answers to those questions.
The history of capitalism is littered with companies that fail because their leaders don't know how to pivot from David to Goliath. It's a real question now for Uber's CEO, a man named Travis Kalanick.
When people start to perceive you as the big guy, you're not allowed to be scrappy, fierce.
Kalanick is on stage a lot. Here at a conference called TechCrunch Disrupt, he gets uncharacteristically pensive.
If you're the little guy, that's cheered, that's lauded, that's the heroic sort of startup story.
NPR reached out to his team to ask if his business depends on flouting regulation or if his stance on local laws will change as Uber enters new cities. A company spokesperson responded, Uber is very supportive of new regulations that make room for innovative options for consumers, options like Uber. Aarti Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.
President Obama has used his executive authority to make some sweeping changes in policy recently on immigration and also diplomatic relations with Cuba. And with the stroke of his pen, he told federal employees that they didn't have to go to work today. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Is this just the latest example of executive overreach from an imperial president?
I'd prefer not to comment on that.
Laura Poole knows a no-win question when she hears one. Poole is a federal worker and says she was excited when she heard about President Obama's executive order.
An extra day off is always a nice thing.
She was already planning to take today as a vacation day, but the executive order made it possible for Poole to take Christmas Eve off as well. 5-day weekend. Based on a random sample of people approached outside of federal office buildings, it seems virtually no one was planning to work on the 26th anyway. Vicki Blackman is among them.
It's almost like a ghost town the day after Christmas anyway, so we're probably saving money by doing that.
Actually, according to the White House Budget Office, the cost is $660 million for a day of payroll and holiday premium pay costs. Ralph Smith is the founder of FedSmith, a website for federal workers.
President Obama is hardly unique in issuing an executive order. Actually, Franklin Roosevelt issued one back in 1940.
That was for Christmas Eve. Giving federal workers a day off, if the 26th falls on a Friday, dates back to 1952 and Harry Truman. It's been a tradition ever since. And Smith says federal employees have gotten used to it.
I wouldn't say they expect it, but they certainly hope for it. Honestly, we got a couple of queries back in April asking us if the president was going to give them the day after Christmas off.
As for January 2nd, which also falls on a Friday this year, there's no similar tradition. It will be a regular workday for the federal workforce. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:19. Actually, it's 8:18. Sorry about that. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, starting January 1st, undocumented residents of California will be eligible to get driver's licenses for the first time. We'll tell you how they're preparing shortly after 8:33. Our weather today, a slight chance of light snow or freezing drizzle in the north today with highs in the 30s and low 40s.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
Make a Kwanzaa placemat and mini gingerbread house. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support seasonal activities for kids. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. After hacks and threats and a temporary cancellation, Sony Pictures' The Interview is now in theaters. NPR's Sam Sanders with more.
Cine Family Theater in Los Angeles was one of over 300 theaters that started showing The Interview on Christmas. Cine Family had a midnight screening, and it sold out. Lauren Monica Larson was in the crowd, and for her, The Interview was about more than just a movie.
Coming to see it isn't just saying, hey, I really like comedy. It's saying, hey, I really believe in free speech and standing up for what we believe in, and it's kind of an American duty to have that standing and that belief.
Even if you don't believe watching a Seth Rogen-directed comedy is your American duty, you can still catch the interview in a few ways. Besides the theaters playing the film, it's available for rent or purchase on YouTube Movies, Google Play, and Microsoft's Xbox Video. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
At least 7 militants are dead today, reportedly killed by U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal area north of Waziristan. NPR's Abdul Sattar is in Islamabad.
This is an area surrounded by rugged mountains. It is known as a hub of Islamists, including the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, Haqqani Network, and other militant outfits.
Sattar says more than 150 militants have been killed in recent days. The family of American Stacey Addison says it's overjoyed to hear of her release from prison in East Timor. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin parents who adopt children from other countries would have to readopt them back home under a series of bills from Republican State Representative Joel Clayfish. It's part of an ongoing campaign to prevent parents from adopting foreign kids online and later the pass of them to out-of-state families with no government oversight. Earlier this year, Governor Walker signed a bill from Clayfish which bans parents from advertising online for informal adoptions. A similar ban was already in place for newspapers and broadcasters. Under the new Clayfish bills, parents would have to post bonds with the state before they bring foreign youngsters home and petition the courts for adoption within 2 months. Counties would follow standard procedures to determine if prospective parents are suitable for adoptions. There would also be new systems for handling disputes and better tracking of child welfare cases. A program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison is helping recently diagnosed breast cancer patients cope and get special comfort from others who have been in their shoes. The University Hospital's Patient Survivor Advocate Program connects those at the front end of treatment with previous survivors. The 20 volunteers counsel women recently diagnosed with breast cancer. The advocates aren't medical professionals, but they do get training from breast cancer specialists. It would be a long shot, but the Green Bay Packers still have a chance to get the number one seed in the NFC playoffs and home field advantage. They'd have to beat the Lions on Sunday, and the Rams would have to beat the Seahawks. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. From the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future, One Opportunity at a Time.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Football fans will be getting in some quality time with their televisions this weekend and next as the NFL regular season ends and the playoffs get started. But many of the year's biggest sports stories had nothing to do with wins and losses on the field. Kevin Blackistone is a sports analyst for television and radio, and he's a journalism professor at the University of Maryland. He came to our studios to chat about the year in sports. Kevin, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invite.
Well, let's start with the NFL.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a year really when what happened off the field got more attention than on the field.
Absolutely.
We saw players accused of child abuse, spousal abuse, bullying other players. I mean, was this maybe the most embarrassing year for the NFL in memory?
It's got to be, no question. I mean, what a tumultuous year for the NFL. No one's talking about Seattle winning the Super Bowl. People are interested in the season now, but clearly the most transcendent stories from the NFL this year are what you just talked about, which have to do with player conduct.
What's your read on how the league has dealt with this so far and the likelihood that they can get past this? And
extremely poorly. I mean, they should be on the show Scandal right now for the way that they've handled this these crises. Clearly, they've come up with a way now going forward to try and deal with personal conduct matters. They've got to come up with some sort of even-handed policy and not the situation they've had this year, which is seemingly to send a trial balloon into the air and see how the public reacts and then decide to mete out punishment that way. You know, the only good thing that has come out of this, certainly on the domestic violence front, is that once again, sports has provided a light on a very serious societal issue unlike any other corner of what we do. And because of that, there's been a great national conversation about how to deal with this problem, no matter if it's in athletics or just in your community. And that's probably a positive thing.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because there was one other story in the NFL that kind of led to a national conversation, mm-hmm. in a way, and that was the story of one young NFL draft pick, Michael Sam, who came out as gay, right. made a lot of news. He's now no longer playing with any team. How do you sort of capture that story and what it meant both for sports and the dialogue over being gay?
I think it changed our viewpoint of what masculinity can be in our society.
Hmm, what do you mean?
That a football player could be crowned make the team. But then the Dallas Cowboys, America's team, went out and picked him up to see if he could fit into their program.
And are you convinced that he did not make those teams because he just didn't have the NFL talents on the field to be part of those teams?
You know, I really am, from having talked to a couple of people who were concerned about his size and his speed and the fact that he might be what they call a tweener, in between two positions rather than being able to dominate one position in the NFL. But I don't think we've heard the last of him, and he has a stick-to-itiveness about him if you read his narrative. I think he'll get another shot, and I think he can bounce back. He wouldn't be the first draft pick to have to fight and claw his way into the NFL.
Let me ask you about two stories that came up in the NBA. Donald Sterling, owner of the LA Clippers, racist right. comments. The entire country sees it. His own players very outspoken about how they felt about that. Eric Garner dies in a chokehold on Staten Island, right. a very well-publicized case, unarmed black man. NBA players wear I Can't Breathe T-shirts to let their voices be heard. Do you see those as related, and what does that tell us about the culture
Absolutely.
In the NBA right now?
I think for the first time in a long time, we've seen athletes understand their collective strength and to empower themselves with that strength to speak their mind about some very important issues that affect them particularly. With the Donald Sterling case and his bigoted comments that came out of his pillow talk with his paramour, and the players that played for him were sickened and disgusted by that. And in particular, a player who didn't play for him, LeBron James, came out and said, if this man is associated with the NBA any longer, I'll refuse to play for it. So I think that was something that we have not seen in a long time. And then you move to the I Can't Breathe campaign and the concern that these athletes have shown for what many in the black community, like them, believe are extrajudicial killings of unarmed black men by police in this country, to join that protest visually with these T-shirts, which happens to be in violation of the NFL and in the NBA of their uniform policies. I like to see players engaged in their communities and feel a sense of empowerment.
I feel like for sports fans, sometimes watching a ball game right. is sort of a sense of release to get away from kind of politics, to get away from the news.
Sports has forever been an escapist arena with the media and for the public. But for those who play it, they are still part of society. And so they don't face any fewer problematic situations than anyone else. And when you're a young black man, whether you're in Ferguson, Missouri, unemployed, trying to figure out a way to make it to community college, or whether you're in the NFL or the NBA, making millions of dollars and hoping that you can drive home safely and not have to worry about an encounter that you may have with a police officer, I think all of that comes together. And I think they see themselves connected to that. And I think it's important that while people watch sports to escape from it, they realize that sports is always reminding us about what is going on in society.
Kevin Blackerstone is a sports analyst and a visiting journalism professor at the University of Maryland. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Maybe you didn't get to read some of the great long-form journalism this year, or perhaps fibbed about reading to the end.
You'll start looking on Twitter and you'll see people tweeting 5 minutes after a 15,000-word story came out, like, incredible read. And you're just like, you didn't read that thing, man. You didn't read that yet.
We did and can recommend a few today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's an incredible listen. This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio. See our complete schedule at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm David Green. Let's toast the Leathers family. The Louisiana couple just welcomed a son into the world and carried on what has become a naming tradition. The father is named Jack Daniels Leathers, so he and his wife Lydia named their baby boy Jim Beam. They say if they have another son, he'll be named Evan Williams, another bourbon brand. If it's a girl, they'll call her Sherry. One final detail from the Terrebonne Parish Courier. The couple was married by a judge named Johnny Walker. You're listening to Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Well, today is the 10-year anniversary of the Indian Ocean tsunami, which killed an estimated 200,000 people across 14 countries. We'll take a look back at how one town has recovered since. Right after this break on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Von Briesen and Roper, Central Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra, and Mineral Point Artisans. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
Wisconsin Classical looks back 10 years to the first concerts in Overture Hall and the voices of Madison joined in music of John Rutter. We also look back on the performing career of a man who touched countless lives in Wisconsin, pianist Howard Karp. Wisconsin Classical in tribute and celebration, this Sunday at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Let's look at the weather. Cloudy and mild to start out the day with a slight chance of light snow or freezing drizzle in the north with highs in the 30s and low 40s. Temperatures, actually, weather should intensify tonight and tomorrow with snowy conditions in the north and rain in the south. And then getting colder early next week by Tuesday, we expect afternoon highs in the single digits and teens. Right now, Superior 30, Madison 36. It's 30 degrees in Green Bay.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks, online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. And from Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. 10 years ago today, the Indian Ocean tsunami killed an estimated 200,000 people across 14 countries. In India, the district of Nagapattinam in the south was the worst hit region. More than 6,000 people died there. Nacha Raman visited recently and filed this report.
The lifeguard doesn't let up on bellowing into the public address system. He's trying to keep pilgrims who bathe in the sea near the Basilica of Our Lady of Good Health safe. Mic in one hand, he clutches a cell phone in the other to receive alerts about any abnormal meteorological events, all part of an early warning system being implemented to avert future disasters along this coast, says the district's top civil servant, T. Munaswamy.
So in 154 seashore villages, the work is going on, this warning system.
The sea has always shaped Nagapattinam's history. Conquerors, missionaries, traders, and colonizers sailed here over the past centuries. But nobody expected these waters to deliver Nagapattinam's biggest shock in this century. The scale of the tragedy prompted pilgrimage centers to provide shelter to those who had lost their homes. The Nago Sufi shrine even opened up its burial ground to Christians and Hindus, in addition to Muslims. Shahul Hamid Saib, who claims to be a descendant of the Sufi saint the shrine is dedicated to, says the scores buried there have not been forgotten by their families.
So every December on 26th, they're visiting here, even in Muslim and non-Muslims all visited here.
This communal integration has been reinforced by mixing up different communities in housing project allotments. Nearly 20,000 new concrete houses have been built at least 500 meters away from the sea for families who were living in huts on the beach. The families may like their new neighbors, but they don't necessarily like their new houses. Many are unhappy with the cramped space, like Rangayan Aravindan, a 64-year-old fisherman.
Here we use the same space to sleep and eat. It's so much less comfortable here than where we were before.
And it's inconvenient for fishing.
From here, we can't tell what the wind and sea are like. When we lived on the beach, we knew how the wind was blowing, what the tide was like.
Down at the beach, fishermen return from a day at sea. They complain about having to venture out as far as neighboring Sri Lanka for a good catch, where their boats are often impounded by Sri Lankan security forces. Factor in rising fuel costs, and fishing is no longer the lucrative business it used to be, says 38-year-old Govindaswamy Vijayan. But he doesn't have much choice, he adds.
We were born into this. For us, other trades aren't viable alternatives.
Women in the fishing community, however, are picking up the slack. Geeta Selvaraj is involved in a catering business now. Before the tsunami, her fisherman husband used to bring home $300 a month. Now he barely manages half of that, whereas her income has doubled.
The money we women earn is a great help to run the home, because our men don't go out to sea all the time.
Like Geeta Selvaraj, people in the district have found ways to cope with their losses, big or small, and rebuild their lives. But they say they haven't forgotten that fateful day. For NPR News, I'm Natcha Raman in Nagapattinam, India.
In California, on January 1st, residents who are living without documentation will be eligible to apply for driver's licenses. That's because of a new law going into effect. The state's Department of Motor Vehicles is expecting 1.6 million immigrants to apply in the first few years. NPR's Nathan Rott reports on preparations for this surge.
It's a Sunday afternoon at Holy Spirit Catholic Church in central Los Angeles, and the pews are packed with about 150 parishioners, not here for a mass, but for a training session. They scribble on notebooks and thumb through pamphlets as presenter after presenter walks up to the lectern and explains AB 60, a law that in a few weeks' time will allow California residents who are living here illegally to be eligible for driver's licenses. That's most of the people in this room. Juan Gonzalez, lieutenant with the Los Angeles Police Department, is one of the presenters.
We know that the city of L.A. has a big immigrant population that doesn't have a driver's license, and they're driving in the city of L.A.
They're driving all over the state, in California cities, rural areas, commuting to and from work and school, or just traveling, like most people do, only in the shadows.
And we know that a lot of the accidents that get caused, we have a lot of hit and runs because of the fear, because they don't have a driver's license.
Which can leave a legal driver, someone with a license, in a bind, and can turn a small incident for the immigrant driving illegally into a misdemeanor or a felony, which leads to arrests, impounding of cars, and just generally bad blood between cops and immigrant drivers.
So it's actually better for the police department for most of our drivers to be licensed and know how to drive.
California isn't the first state to have this kind of law, but California is certainly the biggest. The expected 1.6 million applicants has spurred California's DMV, or Department of Motor Vehicles, to add 800 employees to help with the transition. Community groups and churches like Holy Spirit are helping in their own way, preparing people for the written tests and walking them through the needed documentation.
I was saying to them, take absolute advantage of this and make sure you study very well and pass that exam and be able to get it.
This is Father Aloysius Izianeka, or Father Al. He's an immigrant himself, so he knows how important it was to him to get his own driver's license.
You have no idea how many years a lot of those people have been locking under the darkness of the law, not hoping that nobody catches them.
Churchgoer Marta Quinto knows that well.
You're always afraid to be stopped by the police, and then they can take your car and, like, pay the ticket. That's the hard part. So I'm excited for this opportunity that we have.
And Quinto plans to take full advantage. She's been to every training session, is studying in Spanish and in English, and has already set a date.
I did my appointment already, and I have it for January 2nd at 2 o'clock. So I'm
January
ready.
2nd at 2 o'clock.
Yep.
That's
so
awesome.
I'm ready, yeah.
A day after the new law goes into effect, hopefully, Quinto says, soon after, she'll be able to drive her two kids legally for the first time. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, why 2015 could be a banner year for trade agreements. Our weather today, cloudy and mild with a slight chance of light precipitation in the north with highs in the 30s and low 40s. Plenty of rain and snow tonight and tomorrow.
If you've heard your kid humming the All Things Considered theme song, like one of our members recently told us, maybe it's time to consider increasing your support for Wisconsin Public Radio. You can help keep the exceptional service of WPR humming along by joining the 9XM Leadership Circle with your gift of $100 a month or $1,200 a year or more. Visit WPR.org/support and click leadership. And thanks.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. 2014 will go down as a banner year for the automotive industry, but not in the way car manufacturers would have hoped. NPR Sonari Glinton explains.
2014 is definitely the year of the recall. There have been more than 60 million cars recalled for safety-related defects so far this year. That's more than twice the previous record. And part of what's going on is the auto industry is becoming more simple at the same time as becoming more complex, meaning there are fewer and fewer parts suppliers that are supplying the entire globe. So one bad part can end up affecting not just one car company, but the entire industry.
And Glinton says with cars now being more computer than machine, a lot can happen. President Obama is continuing his vacation in Hawaii. He spent part of his Christmas thanking troops at an oceanfront marine base.
The world is better. It's safer. It's more peaceful, it's more prosperous, and our homeland is protected because of you.
The president says the country still has some very difficult missions around the world, especially in Iraq, where U.S.-led coalition forces are countering the self-proclaimed Islamic State. A somber 2 days are planned in New York as family and friends say their goodbyes to police officer Rafael Ramos. He was one of the two officers killed last weekend while sitting in a patrol car in Queens. A wake for Ramos is today. His funeral will be tomorrow. Vice President Joe Biden plans to attend that funeral. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Dontre Hamilton supporters will try to get more national attention for their cause when they hold a news conference and rally tomorrow in Chicago with Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition. Hamilton supporters got their wish for a federal investigation after a Milwaukee prosecutor said on Monday he would not charge a fired city police officer, Christopher Manny, for shooting Hamilton to death in late April. District Attorney John Chisholm says he most likely would not have won a conviction had he charged Manny, saying the officer acted in self-defense. A company in Missouri has recalled its Happy Apple brand of caramel apples, saying they might have been contaminated with listeria. At least three people died in a 10-state outbreak in which three people from Wisconsin are reported to get sick, along with 26 others at last word. Happy Apple's recall includes 31 states, including Wisconsin. The products in question were sold in packs of 1, 3, 4, and 8 caramel apples with a use-by date of between August 25th and November 23rd.
Giannis Antetokounmpo is the only Milwaukee Buck to appear on the NBA's first All-Star fan balloting results released on Christmas Day. The second-year forward from Greece is in eighth place among Eastern Conference guards with 17,512 votes. Fan voting ends January 19th. The NBA All-Star game is February 15th in New York City. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate high school prepared for success in college and career. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. And from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. On the web at PAMM.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Ice skating is one of the pleasures of winter. Many neighborhoods have their own rinks. John Hildebrand tells us about learning to skate backwards.
Last year, the city announced it was mothballing most of the neighborhood ice skating rinks. A city crew would no longer flood the rinks on successive freezing nights or pay listless teenagers to sit in overheated warming huts. Budget cuts was the reason given, though there was also a string of freakishly warm winters. As a consolation prize, a few large rinks remain open. But I miss the one in our neighborhood, the one we could walk to, the one where my children learned to skate. It's one more instance of the landscape of childhood giving way to that notoriously poor substitute, memory. But whose memory? One of the weird pleasures of parenthood is making children reenact some tableau from your own childhood, and nothing is rigged with deja vu like a skating rink at night. It's one big memory sink, the dome of darkness overhead, the scuffle of skates, the way everything shimmers in the cold night air. I have a persistent memory of skating backwards with a girl under the lights. It's a school night, and I've been dropped at the city rink. Snow is falling heavily out of a blackness that begins just beyond the arc lights. And there's music. The entire rink revolves slowly on its axis as a loudspeaker blares the skater's waltz. Among those orbiting past is a girl from my class, someone I've never spoken to, but whose mere presence elicits a strange new excitement. She's wearing a nubby blue sweater and a short woolen skirt that's left her bare legs red in the cold. I push off, weaving between skaters until she's just ahead, trailing a fragrance equal parts wool, freshly washed hair, and chewing gum. A few powerful strokes and I glide past her, then, amazing, pivot, so we're face to face, skating in perfect rhythm as she smiles and offers up her arms. Except it never happened. I didn't learn to skate backwards until I was in my 30s. So the whole episode is a false memory, a scene concocted out of adolescent longing or something I must have read. When I finally learned, the knowledge came too late. Too late to play hockey or meet girls, but in plenty of time for me to teach my own kids to skate. Now that the kids are grown, my wife and I will sometimes drive to one of the remaining rinks on a winter night and circle the ice in an approximation of a waltz. It looks romantic only because you can't see the stagecraft, the hand squeezing that signals a turn, or the way we keep time by humming the brutal cadence of the skater's waltz. Dum, dum, da, 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 dum, while alternately pushing and pulling each other around the rink. It's not dancing so much as balancing, a kind of novelty act, marriage on ice. Still, when we lock arms and go into a spin, faster and faster, and everything blurs together except her astonished blue eyes, I think, this must be love.
John Hildebrand is the author of several books. His latest is The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. You can find out more information about Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and Facebook.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
NPR News.
I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Classical music comes your way at 9 o'clock. Today's highlights include The Carnival of the Animals by Camille Saint-Saëns and a flute concerto by Bach. Join Ruth Ann Bessman right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
In Madison, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
Our weather in Wisconsin today, mostly cloudy and mild, with a slight chance of light snow or freezing drizzle in the north, with highs in the 30s and low 40s. By tonight, the weather could get more eventful with snowy conditions in the north and rain in the south, and that should last through tomorrow. Sunday, it'll start to get colder, and by Tuesday, we expect afternoon highs. These are afternoon highs in the single digits and lower 20s.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College, indispensable and in demand. Be that person with an administrative professional degree. Classroom and real-world experience. Learn online or in the classroom. Median starting salary, $31,000. Information at gtc.edu.
The hackers who tried to steal Christmas for Microsoft and Sony gaming fans.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in Washington Today, I'm David Brancaccio. Christmas is always a busy day for Microsoft Xbox and Sony PlayStation's computers as people unwrap their new game consoles and try to log on. But in what may be the Grinch move of the season, hackers claim to have orchestrated a digital attack that has been slowing or halting those gaming networks since yesterday. Ben Johnson with our sibling program, Marketplace Tech, joins us. Good morning, my friend.
Morning, David.
We're hearing about the group allegedly behind this. What do we know so far?
Yeah, so the group taking responsibility is called Lizard Squad. This is a group of so-called black hat hackers that actually has a history of attacking gaming networks and saying that the big companies making the games don't spend enough time making video games better for the user. Lizard Squad posted messages on Twitter saying they were responsible for taking their networks down and said they would stop their attacks if users retweeted their messages on Twitter. Though we should note, as always, that beyond taking their word for it, it's always hard to identify the origin of these kinds of attacks.
Do you have any idea how the hackers, if it was hackers, brought down these networks?
Well, Lizard Squad has messed with live gaming networks before with DDoS or distributed denial of service attacks by overwhelming the system. Gamers were actually able to play games offline, just not able to play games that required an internet connection.
It's a bad day for Microsoft, but for Sony, this seems like adding embarrassment to injury or worse.
The latest hack suggests that Sony still doesn't have its house in order when it comes to protecting against hacking attacks. We should note, though, that as far as hacking goes, this attack seems very different from the one leveled at Sony Pictures, both in target, alleged origin, and also motivation. Both companies have acknowledged issues and say they're working on them, and people may start to come online today.
All right, we'll watch for that. Marketplace Tech host Ben Johnson. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 23 minutes into trading on this post-Christmas day, is up 67 points, a 3%. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ Composite Index currently up 0.5%. Milder weather means less demand for natural gas heating, and natural gas futures fell to their lowest level in 2 years today. Want to not make friends or to influence people at, say, a bar? Try going on about trade policy. But NAFTA and other trade agreements may have altered the texture of American business and the job market more than any other set of policies. And there are new trade agreements in the works that could play prominently in our coverage in 2015. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has been working on a preview. Good morning, Tracy.
Morning, David.
All right, so set the stage here on this trade policy.
Oh, man, we have a regular alphabet soup of acronyms. ITA, FTA, TPP. I promise not to use any of them.
She promises, but she just did use them.
But the big green light from the end of 2014 was a global trade facilitation agreement. It's possibly this trillion-dollar deal that seeks to smooth international customs procedures, among other things, for how goods move from place to place. This agreement, reached back in November, was a pretty big deal. Combine that with progress on another deal that would reduce tariffs on certain technology goods, and suddenly there's some hope for a whole slew of other agreements. Here's Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute.
I would expect 2015 to be a pretty good year for trade because you have a number of irons in the fire. We're talking about an okay year or a very good year. Those are our two choices here.
Lots of deals in the works, lots of countries involved, so also lots of opportunities for those deals to get hung up or delayed.
I mean, when he says a good or decent year for trade, that is if the trade deals are structured in a way that ultimately creates jobs, don't exploit foreign workers, or wreck the environment, critics will say. But that said, what's up first?
Probably something here at home called the Trade Promotion Authority. Congress gives the U.S. president a list of priorities or guidelines around trade and gives him the power to negotiate deals. Congress still gets to approve those deals, but as long as the agreement follows the guidance they set up, it's a straight up or down vote, no amendments. This authority needs to be renewed, which Congress seems likely to take up in the new year. Scissors says the outcome of that could be a bellwether of sorts.
Does it happen when it's supposed to happen? Does it pass? If it gets delayed or there's a vote and it fails, we've lost most of the momentum.
If it does pass, well, then we likely move on to a Pacific trade agreement. 12 countries, including Japan, which would further open its agriculture market to U.S. goods. If that passes, it bodes well for a European trade agreement, and so on.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Nuance Power PDF, designed for powerful business functionality that's scalable for the entire organization. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
What was the nadir of service in the economy class cabin, beyond Ryanair in Europe charging to use the toilet? Maybe it was being dunned $3 for a Sprite on a flight to Sacramento that time. Some airlines these days are now trying to make life in coach a bit less contemptuous, with fluffier headrests, bigger video screens. But as Sam Harnett reports, this is happening even as the seats are getting smaller.
The whole shrinking airplane seat situation makes Joe Brancatelli think of a Marx Brothers joke.
Groucho calls up and says, "Hello, room service, can you send up more room?"
Instead, they send more people to Groucho's tiny room. Brancatelli runs Joe Sent Me, a website for business travelers. He says perks like larger video screens are distractions from slimmer seats, which are now 7 inches less than an average desk chair. Meanwhile, he says first class keeps getting nicer.
It really is a yawing gap culturally, and people are beginning to seize on this and say, well, it's just like what's going on in society.
The growing difference between first class and coach is something Chris Lapinto's noticed. He's co-founder of ExpertFlyer.com, and he points to how American Airlines is concentrating more on first class as it upgrades its fleet.
That's the way it is because that's where a lot of the revenue comes from.
Lapinto says American Airlines economy flyers will get some upgrades, like more personal video screens, power outlets, and pay-as-you-go Wi-Fi. As for the seats, he says, if anything, they're going to get a tad smaller. I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
We're also reporting today on an experiment at Walmart to let people swap gift cards from competitors. You don't get the full value from the other card. If you missed our coverage on the air, it's part of our Morning Report podcast online. What sticks out for me is the estimate that people will waste $1 billion this year by either losing or forgetting gift cards that still had value. In Washington today, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you throughout the day with headlines from NPR and WPR at noon, All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30 this afternoon, and stories to listen to, read, and comment on anytime at WPR.org.
WPR is committed to unbiased journalism, interesting stories, and smart entertainment. Member support is the single biggest piece of our funding. It makes all the programs you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Thank you to our members.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
You're listening to WGTD.